afternoon, James. How are you?
Hi, JP. Hope you feel better.
All right.
I'm sending you good energy.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you. Basically, I'll be kind of rolling around. I can't sit still very much because the pain in my stomach makes me have to walk around a lot. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to let you on. The floor is yours for the next 55 minutes and then 55 minutes more after the break. So be well and have a great time. So,
thank you.
James Barkley, ladies and gentlemen, please introduce yourself.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. My name is James Barkley. I've been in the field for nigh on 25 years in the field of alien abduction research, investigations into alien underground undersea bases, the deep black connection between ongoing connection between elements of the military aerospace, deep black medical community on the one hand, and non-human life forms on the other in the underground bases, and in truth also in off-world settings. Many people refer to this as the secret space program or the breakaway civilization, as Richard Dolan calls it, or also a generic term people use nowadays is my labs, military abductees, who are legitimate alien abductees who are also at times kidnapped, mind-controlled, trained, and utilized as operational assets in a variety of ways by deep black elements of the military and aerospace community. And I had my own ET experiences, and I was the beneficiary of great mentorship from Barbara Bartholik, the late Barbara Bartholik of Tulsa, Oklahoma. When I met her, she'd already been in the field for a long time, around 30 years, in alien abduction research. She also worked on a number of cattle mutilation cases, but mostly her field was alien abductions. Her first and foremost protege was the late Dr. Carla Turner, who was also a friend of mine. Carla, known as Candy to her friends, wrote a number of seminal books on the subject of alien abductions, including Into the Fringe and also Taken, Inside the Alien Abduction, forget the subtitle, Inside the Alien-Human Abduction Syndrome. And Taken was a book about eight different female MyLabs, describing in detail their alien abduction and military abduction experiences. So, and there were other people along the way who guided me and pointed me in the right direction, and I'll always be thankful to them. And so my goal here today is to provide your listeners with a lot of insight, earned the old-fashioned way, having lived through it, as well as networking with people around the world, especially in the Internet age, who have had these experiences. And so, you know, whenever you feel it's appropriate, I can begin.
Oh, thank you so much, James. Let's see, oh, there's so many interesting areas to explore. So, please, whatever you feel is the most pressing thing, because, I mean, one of the things you said is, like, the Internet has made everything change. You know, we can have international free calls for nothing across the world and talk for as long as you like with however many people that you want. And information can be shared like this with, you know, between people who have had experiences and, you know, in Internet radio as well. So, do you want to talk about how it was before and how it is now? Or, well, I mean,
yes.
Just talk about how you are.
Yes,
that's a very good point. In the old days, we only really, this is pre-internet, we happened to meet others who've had similar experiences, usually at the battleground known as a UFO conference or alien abduction contactee support group meeting, right? And I say battleground, and I only mean that half tongue-in-cheek, because oftentimes those places would be the settings for quite acrimonious debate and mudslinging between various factions. Some people, the false positives, I call them, people who adamantly refuse to believe that there could possibly be any negative aliens throughout this whole cosmos, indeed throughout this whole multiverse, that it's only bad humans or military doing all this. And then there is the other camp where these are people that know they've had encounters with less than pleasant beings, negative beings, and they've been subjected to quite painful and frightening experiences. And the people in the latter category, I count myself in that camp, we are not all doom and gloom. I should point this out, that many of us have also had encounters with positive beings, but we feel it's important to underscore the fact that there are these beings out there that do not have our best interest in mind, and they routinely strive to take away our human sovereignty and our dignity when they do these negative acts to us. So oftentimes these support groups would kind of degenerate into a lot of mudslinging and whatnot. Myself and Eve Lorgan, for many years, she and I had two groups. Actually, we had an alien abduction support group, which was a larger group made up of, you know, sometimes good attendance days. And there would be a lot of spiritual warfare that would erupt in the hours and days leading up to these abductee support groups. I've known we had cases where people had driven 2 hours from Orange County to get to Fallbrook, Fallbrook, which is just north of San Diego, North County San Diego, and two people had fought through the Southern California freeway traffic, pulled up in front of Eve's house, and sat there, and all of a sudden they got this overwhelming urge to suddenly just drive away and go back whence they came. This is after fighting through 2 hours of Southern California freeway traffic, and anyone who's lived there knows what I'm talking about. And then they forced themselves to get out of the car and walked up to the door and rang the doorbell. And even as Eve walked to the front door to answer it, they were still debating whether they should turn around and leave. And at least those two fought through the interference and the spiritual warfare and were committed to attending that particular meeting. There are many others who, over the years when we had that support group, all kinds of spiritual warfare would occur. Their kids would get sick on the eve of the support group meeting. They would have car problems, et cetera, et cetera. I saw this also as far as people who were trying to attend a UFO conference where someone like myself or a colleague or someone I didn't know was going to share similar information. Well, these people would have car problems. They would get ill. They would have a squabble with their partner or their spouse or whatever the case may be. And oftentimes they would not be able to attend the conference. That's just how it goes. And kudos to those people who would battle through all that and still make the effort to get to these conferences in the past. So in the old days, pre-internet, before the internet really took off, we only really had an opportunity to meet other contactees and alien abductees at UFO conferences or at a support group meeting. And there was a few. Eve and I had one in Fallbrook, which is North County, San Diego. There was another group in Los Angeles area in Los Angeles, and when these conferences would happen in the old days, these conferences were and UFO lectures were quite common. Actually, I'm not sure. I haven't been involved in conferences and lectures lately, so I don't know how common they are today. But they were quite common in the old days, and so I always found the meetings after the meetings, i.e., after the lectures, when we could all just let our hair down, go up to a hotel room or go to a cafe somewhere on site or nearby, and we could just share, speak from the heart, speak our truth, and not be judged. It was just so gratifying to meet others who've had similar experiences. There was an unspoken understanding between us. And I remember clearly, I believe it was in 1992, It was this epic international UFO Congress at the now defunct or non-existent Showboat, which was a hotel casino in Las Vegas. Some of your listeners in Vegas probably remember this. It's since been imploded and torn down. But that was the site of the International UFO Congress. And back in the old days, the UFO Congresses were very contactee, very abduction-heavy orientated. And then after a while, it became more science-oriented, more speakers there to talk about free energy or whatever the case may be, which is still important. But I've always felt that where the best information came from was those who had the encounter experiences with the non-human life forms. And the 92, I believe it was, International Congress was a seminal event. Dr. Carla Turner and her husband Elton Turner were there. Daryl Sims was a abduction researcher from the Houston, Texas area was there. And a number of people, a number of alien abductees made the journey. I was there for the whole week, and it was quite an experience. On one night, Rob, who was the at the time the director of the San Diego UFO Society and an old buddy of mine, and Charles Hickson, the late Charles Hickson, who was one of the abductees in the Pascagoula, Mississippi abduction of October 1973. He and his friend Calvin Parker were fishing in a dock in Pascagoula, Mississippi, when they were abducted, taken on board, et cetera, et cetera. And Charlie, Rob, and a couple other guys, we took the UFO Congress shuttle van. And we went, and I'm not a gambler by any means. We went to a number of casinos that night, and you know, I dropped a few quarters into slot machines and whatnot, and. So it was great to just be able to hang around these people and to talk to them and share with them. And then I remember distinctly what happened after that, the emotional aftermath, the emotional meltdown. And I since, after the fact, found out this happened to a number of people where we spend a whole week around others like ourselves where we can just speak freely, speak from the heart, share our ET experiences, our UFO sightings, with no worry about censure or ridicule or any kind of debunking. And then to be abruptly pulled away from that. And I do believe there was an element of alien manipulation in how we felt afterwards, the emotional aftermath. Because I remember I was at McCarran Airport and I was getting ready. I was waiting for my flight, actually, to go back to San Diego, and I still had a few hours to go, 4 or 5 hours, really, or more, but I took the shuttle van from the conference site, and I was sitting there in the airport lobby, like, hours before my flight, and it all just hit me that I was going back to the world, not just the world, this world, this fake matrix simulation we see all around us, but I was going back to work for Naval Air Force's U.S. Pacific Fleet. I was in communications, working in communications at the time. And so, you know, that grim realization hit me that, oh, God, I've got to go back there. And I became very emotional and began crying, actually. And on a whim, I decided to call up a buddy of mine that I knew back from the old San Jose, California days. And he'd since relocated to Vegas. I gave him a ring, said, sorry, I can't hook up with you and hang out. I got a flight to catch. I'm at the airport right now. He asked me, well, when is your flight leave? Well, it's not for about 5 or 6 hours. And he says, stay right there. I'm coming over. So he picked me up, took me back to his place. We had a feast. You know, we, you know, toasted one another. And we had a really good time. And I'm glad he took the trouble to do that for me. And then eventually he dropped me back off, took my flight back to San Diego. And then I remember when I went back to work, it was a poignant moment. I was in the message center in a secure area within an already secure place. And I was standing in front of this heavy duty, shredding machine. And I was you know, putting all these classified documents in there to be shredded. And the dichotomy hit me at that point. Like one moment, I was with all these alien abductees from all over the place, all over the world, not just all over the U.S., and we're sharing, we're hanging out, we're having a great time. And there were so many spooks at that 92 International UFO Congress. There was these spooks, mind-controlled spooks, that were dressed kind of like hippies, that followed Leah Haley from one city to another. They were even there at that Congress to, like, you know, pull psyops on her and harass her and whatnot. Leah Haley was an alien abductee and a MILAB from Mississippi. And there was all these other spooks there. It was one of the most spook-laden conferences I'd ever been to. So there was that push-pull, that dichotomy between us and them, right? Next thing you know, I'm back in San Diego. I'm in the secure message center. I'm shredding all these documents. And then the irony of it all hit me. Here I am back, not only back in this matrix simulation, I'm in a secure facility and I'm shredding classified documents. It's like, you know, I'm back working for them again, in other words. And I was crying. I was standing there in front of that shredding machine, just boo-hooing with tears pouring out of my eyes. Now, what was interesting was I spoke to a gal named Connie on the phone. She was from Colorado, and she'd attended the conference, and I'd met her there for the first time. In fact, it was Connie's friend, Kurt, who coined the term the alien love bite, which my friend Eve Lorgan popularized. Connie's friend Kurt had gone through this whole drama of the love obsession, as my mentor Barbara Barthel called it, basically emotional energetic harvesting of two targeted alien love bite partners who've been put together in a scenario beginning basically in childhood and extending into adulthood, where they fall madly in love with each other, and for a variety of reasons, they go through all this emotional upheaval, and the aliens just harvest all that energy and emotions, and the emotions run the gamut from joy to pure love, all the way to an unrequited love, pining away for the other person, misery, jealousy, rage, et cetera, all points in between. And so anyway, Connie's friend Kurt was the one that came up with that term, the alien love bite. Anyway, I'm talking to Connie on the phone, and I said, yeah, I had a really rough time after that conference. I broke down in tears, at the gate area waiting for my flight. And then when I got back to San Diego and started working at the airbase again, I started crying again, you know. And she said the same thing happened to her, and the same thing happened to a number of other people that she knew, other alien abductees who'd attended that conference. It was like we were all unplugged all at the same time, and we all went through this emotional upheaval. And of course, that only really benefits these negative parasitic aliens. To be sure, there's an element of, you know, feeling like you've been pulled away from your kin, your extended star family, if you will. But the depth and the level of the emotional outpouring was such that I'm sure it was a form of emotional energetic harvesting. But to cycle back to your question, that's how it was in the old days. We just had to go to conferences and meet with people. And once we got to know people, we'd exchange phone numbers. And, you know, back then we spent a lot of time on the phone. And then, the internet age comes along. And then we realize, holy cow, there's hordes of other people out there on the internet, and they're putting up bulletin boards and putting up websites and whatnot. So I'll probably talk more about it later, but before the show is over. But I do want to talk about the dangers of the internet age, because there's a lot of online predators, what I've referred to as astral rapetoids. These are human-reptilian hybrid host, as well as Draco-human hybrid host, who are astral operators, and some of them are full-on adepts and warlocks and black magicians, and they delight in astrally projecting themselves and astrally raping women that they find on the internet. They like to lurk in the old days, before social media, before a lot of this instant messaging. They used to lurk on these forums and bulletin boards, and when some really switched on gal would come online and start talking about her experiences and start talking about her different psychic abilities, these astral reptoids would lock into their energetic signature and would almost immediately, in some cases, begin astrally projecting themselves and astrally raping these women. And sometimes this astral rape and astral abuse would carry on for a long time and mixed in with a lot of psychological warfare on the bulletin boards and in the messages themselves, like little comments made by the astral rapetoid the day after, the morning after an astral rape, just to kind of rub it in. I mean, they wouldn't come right out and say they did what they did, but they would coach their words in such a way as to let the woman know, yeah, that was me last night. It was not a dream, and it's real. It's going to continue, because a lot of these astral rapetoids are perps. Anyway, so that's what it was like in the old days. Fast forward to today. We have whole forums online. We have a lot of online groups of people that have experiences. So it's been interesting watching this development over time, and we've come a long way. We really have. We no longer have to go hat in hand to the bogus scientific community and beg and plead for acceptance. They used to just circle the wagons anyway and try to big shot us with their bogus knowledge. But now we don't need to do that. Now they're on the back heel. They're on the back foot. And they have to struggle to stay relevant. We're the ones that are in the ascendant, if you will. Did you want to comment on any of that, JP?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Evie Logan, absolutely gorgeous. I the first time I heard her on another show, I said, oh, I got to have her on. She just, and the same with you. You've both got a voice. I'm a musician, and I got very, you know, subtle ears. Hearing both of your voice has a sense of richness that is not always available to a lot of people. It's like you got other dimensions to the voice. There's an encoding in there. And I'm sure people have told you that before. In that what you're talking about is more than the words that you're saying and the cadence you're using. So that's one thing I wanted to say. And I'll have Evie back on in a few weeks' time, actually, on Ever Beyond. So do tune in, everybody, on the Sunday. But yeah, so there was then and now, and how we go about it. Now, I have a theory.
It is my theory.
No, it's not my own theory. It's I imagine it's pretty, it would be, alright. So my theory is that, those who are my labs are actually taken by their people, and the my labs are there to debrief them and find out what they found out, and the helicopters and everything are there to detect the, like, ionic trails, as they were saying in Star Trek, or whatever traces that they may find of the UFO that took them. That's my theory. How close is that theory to your experiences?
Yes, that's part and parcel of it, because some of these craft, these ET craft, do emit a frequencies which have long since been identified and tracked by the various military government spook agencies like the NSA and Naval Intelligence and Air Force Office of Special Investigations, et cetera, all these deep black elements within said agencies. They know the emissions put out by these craft, and because they have so much access to the medical records, not just of military or retired military personnel or the dependents of military personnel, but in the larger civilian population at large. They have a very good idea of who the abductees are, alien abductees, contactees are, in the larger population. And when they begin to have all these readings indicating that there's a lot of ET craft activity in a given area, they will send not just helicopters around with advanced sensors to pick up any residual energetic signature, but they will send these vans, a lot of these white vans with tinted windows, Also, these sedans, these four-door sedans, oftentimes a Crown Vic or a Suburban. Sometimes they'll have tinted windows as well. And sometimes these sedans, the dashboards of these sedans can be filled with all kinds of what seems to be high-tech gear. And there could be a bunch of aerials on top of the sedans for communications purposes. So they know that UFO activity is going on in a certain suburb, and then they narrow it down to a certain neighborhood. Because once they identify this activity going on there, they fine-tune their sensors for a given area. And then they begin to do the background profiling of the people living there. Okay, well, who lives in this house? Interesting. Native American, Cherokee, and Scotch-Irish heritage of this person. This bears looking into. And then they begin monitoring the phone and internet combo of the people, say that they, their short list of people that they feel may be having these experiences. That's presupposing these people were not on their radar to begin with. But if they were not on their radar to begin with, they'll do a full court press so to speak, where they begin monitoring their phone conversations, so on and so forth, and they look for keywords. So if in our example, this woman with the Scotch-Irish Cherokee genetic heritage is on the phone with one of her girlfriends, and she's saying, I had another dream last night. I was on board this craft, and there was this big bug-looking being, kind of looked like an overgrown praying mantis, et cetera, et cetera. Well, words like UFOs, aliens, et cetera, those are keywords, which the Echelon system, and I believe there's a standalone system that works over and above Echelon that's dedicated specifically to identifying, tracking, monitoring the communications of alien abductees and contactees. So then they begin monitoring the conversations. They hear her utilizing terms like aliens, UFOs. Maybe she might mention the names of certain well-known researchers in the field, Bud Hopkins, whoever the case may be. And then what happens is, in order to instill some paranoia, the controllers, the phone monitoring spooks, may begin making clicking sounds. And I went through this too. Many people have, where they begin to hear these clicking sounds on the phone. Sometimes the phone will ring, the person will answer it, and there'll be a pause. They won't hear anything. Then they'll hear a couple of clicks, click, 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 click. And suddenly, the dial tone will happen, or it'll just continue until the person hangs up. And it doesn't matter sometimes where the person goes. The person can start hearing these clicks on phones at work. And I'm really talking here pre-mobile phone, pre-cell phone days. I don't know if people hear these clicks on cell phones. I really haven't asked or heard about it, but I know on landlines it was very common. And so if they decide that, in our example, this woman has some potential as a MyLab, they will abduct her. In the old days, they used to show up. Let's say it was a single-income family. They would wait for the husband to go to work in the morning, and then they would show up at the door. This was especially the case in the high desert, those dusty high desert towns of Southern California, like Lancaster, Victorville, Barstow, Palmdale, places like that, Ridgecrest, China Lake. They would wait for the husband to go to work, and then a van would pull up in the front yard, and then sometimes they would just show up in their military uniforms. Or sometimes they would wear these black SWAT-type BDUs, battle dress utilities, but they'd be all in black with a black ball cap. And sometimes they would be carrying this black box, which has been described by many abductees and my labs before. And the black box that the military carry, it emits these frequencies, which can render everyone in the household, including pets, dogs and cats, it can render them unconscious, except for the person they're targeting. And then, they'll just knock on the door, and the lady will answer. And either they'll just induce some kind of altered state in her with that black box, or they can be quite violent in the old days too, and probably in some cases it's still the same, where they can just physically assault her. I've known of cases where they've sprayed the MyLab with an aerosol that emits some kind of citrusy kind of smell, which renders the woman unconscious and listless. They've also been known to jolt women with handheld so-called non-lethal weapons. They look like little cylinders with little like sharp prods at one end, and they use it to jolt the person, incapacitate them. They like to place these at the back of the neck and in different places like that. That's what they did to Leah Haley before. And it's a variety of means by hook and crook to haul them out to the van, and then they drive them off, oftentimes winding up either on a surface military installation or a subsurface underground base, or even to hotel, rather corporate office suites in some office building somewhere in town, because they have those too. And yes, sometimes they would question the people. What do you know about the aliens? Why are you reading such and such book by Carla Turner? What do the aliens look like? What do they want from you, right? And that's kind of what it was like in the old days. But since then, and actually for quite some time, they've been utilizing these people as operational assets. Depending on what their conscious surface-level skill set is, some people have, like, say, a biomed, biotech background, and in the underground bases, in an altered state of consciousness, they may be used in a laboratory performing work. And other people, they may have, you know, a certain degree of physical fitness, and they can be used in what amounts to military operations and subjected to a lot of military training with weapons, lots of long-distance running, swimming, lots of swimming. They're taught survival skills. Your listeners that used to be in the military are familiar with the term SEER, survival, escape, resistance, evasion. Foraging and eluding pursuers. And then once they get captured, being taught how to resist harsh interrogation. Well, a lot of my labs are subjected to that. They're trained to forage, and they also try to determine if someone has leadership capability, whether it's a male or a female. And they will put my labs together in groups in these scenarios. And these scenarios can be physical in our 3D training, or some kind of like virtual environment kind of thing, where they are made to believe, and the surroundings, the countryside, kind of lend credence to the belief that they are survivors of some kind of apocalyptic meltdown, whether it's NBC nature, nuclear, biological, chemical, earth changes, whatever the case may be. And then they'll have the MyLab trying to determine the leadership qualities of MyLabs. They'll appoint one person to be a leader, and he or she will task the other MyLabs with certain jobs. Okay, you go find clean water. Okay, you find some firewood. Okay, you find some edible plants, whatever the case may be. And they're graded, and they're they're psychologically profiled to find out who's capable of doing what. If someone has a psychological profile of a narcissist, sociopath, kind of a reptilian hybrid genetically, those people will make good military operatives, maybe even assassins. But some people that don't fall into that profile, they will find some other use for them. They will strive to slot them into a certain category. And so, yes, in the old days, they would interrogate these people. And I've known of cases where my labs were interrogated about their most recent past life. Yes, that I've known of cases like that, where tell us about your past life in Germany during World War II. What do you remember, et cetera, et cetera. These people, these my labs, And again, my definition of a MILAB is as a legitimate alien abductee slash contactee who also has military experiences where they're at times, sometimes quite frequently, kidnapped, mind controlled, sometimes even tortured, trained and utilized as an operational asset. It could be, again, in a laboratory type setting, or say if someone has like a medical background on the surface, as a nurse or as an intern or even as a doctor, they may use that person in the underground bases or the off-world installations in the same or a similar capacity. You utilize them in their surface level, consciously aware profession. So it just depends. And I've known of cases where the military will encourage my labs to train as a first responder, as an ambulance, emergency medical technician, EMT, or a firefighter. And they are told these are skills they will need at some unspecified point in the future, because a lot of the training my labs receive, or some of them anyway, has to do with surviving any kind of contingency. And the contingencies vary from mega earth changes due to celestially driven cataclysms, fireballs coming out of the sky, so on and so forth, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, civil unrest, nuclear war, foreign army occupations, et cetera, et cetera. They're put sometimes in what seems to be a virtual reality environment where they are put through their paces, and they're expected to not only survive but thrive in these various scenarios that are presented to them. A very common scenario is one or more my labs trying to get from one end of a war-torn city to another, eluding pursuers the whole time. And these stories and scenarios, as been described to me, they go back to the early and mid-90s. And what's interesting is what the my labs described then in these scenarios that they've been put through, that the skies would be just filled with what we take for granted now as fake clouds and chemtrails, but not so much in those days, right? And the skies would be filled with these fake clouds, and they'd be in a war-torn city. There'd be black helicopters all over the place. There would be UFOs and flying saucers and black man-made alien replicated craft flying around. And these people going through this training have to avoid all that. They have to hide out in amidst the ruins and rubble of a war-torn city. So it really runs the gamut. They can be used and trained individually or used and trained in groups. And the environments, the settings that people describe can vary from hospital, medical clinic type settings where they find themselves in a hospital gown or a hospital smock or sometimes buck naked. And they may be laying in a hospital bed, and they're being treated and worked on by what appear to be nurses, what appear to be medical doctors, and sometimes they're around military people, and they can find themselves in the corridors of these underground bases, and sometimes there's not many people there, just them and maybe a few medical people and maybe the odd military person, and sometimes the corridors are teeming with other presume my labs, people walking around in a zombied out state in hospital gowns or sometimes completely naked or in their night clothes. And the people will, depending on the individual, they will have, varying states of consciousness. Some my labs, and they're kind of, a rarity, can retain an astonishing amount of conscious awareness during their my lab experiences. For whatever reason, and I do believe sometimes the military allows certain people, particularly certain women based on their psychological profile, to have more conscious awareness than others, because they know that these women, based on their psych profile, will not go public, will not talk about their experiences, and these women, some of them will be quite isolated. They won't have a lot of alien abductee or MILAB friends with which they can confide in. It's really just them and usually oftentimes an unsupportive, skeptical husband, right? who represents kind of a built-in control system. And so, yeah, it varies. But I would say at this point that there are countless MyLabs. If some of the scenarios that's been described to me have any validity to them, sometimes these MyLabs can find themselves in mass kind of inoculation settings where they're all lined up and they're taking it in turns to get it to the front of the line where there's a small table and a nurse and medical personnel, and they're getting injected with something, right? And there could be hordes of these people. And other times people describe how their whole neighborhood, and this happens sometimes in the high desert of Southern California, probably other places from what I've heard, where in the middle of the night, the military will take out an entire neighborhood, maybe not every single household, but a significant number of people in a number of households, take them out of their homes in a mind-controlled state, and then herd them off either in buses and or vans, and then take them all to what's been described sometimes as like a like an auditorium setting, a very common setting that MyLabs describe is what appears to be a high school gymnasium or an auditorium with bleacher seats and with a basketball court, et cetera, or they're taken to like a what they call an elementary or junior high school, a multi-purpose room in these schools in the middle of the night where a military person would brief all these people and oftentimes tell them about some unspecified kind of catastrophe or something that's coming down the pike at some unspecified point in the future. Other commonly reported settings are underground train systems, like train platforms, trams, where one or sometimes more or sometimes, like once again, hordes of presumed MyLabs are being herded onto underground trams and underground trains and taken to places because beneath our feet, in truth, is a worldwide tunnel system. And some of these trains operate on maglev, magnetically levitated principles. And they can go from, say, Paris to Tokyo in no time flat. That's how fast some of these things are. They don't ride on rails. They ride on a cushion of magnetism. And so
abductees
in my lab, right? Yeah, they're supersonic. So those are just one of a number of settings that people describe. Sometimes people find themselves in purely military settings, like in a military office setting where everybody, including sometimes the MyLab, will be wearing military uniforms, BDUs, whether it's just plain green or camouflage pattern, or even sometimes more of a dress uniform. They can find themselves in conferences where they're sitting in a large table and there's military people there and they're all talking. And what the MyLabs have to understand is, when it seems as if the MyLab can't hear what's going on all around them, and they're in one of these military scenarios, and they may even be dressed as a military person, and when these people, these military people, oftentimes of high rank, are addressing them, and these military people seem to be having a discourse, a conversation with them, but they don't hear a single word, what's happening is their normal conscious personality has been shunted to the back seat, if you will, and they've pulled forward an alter personality which has its own personality, has its own institutional memory, has its own skill set, and may have different language skills which are not consciously available to the front alter of the person in question. And that is who the military is talking to. That's why the MyLab, if they have any degree of conscious awareness at all, can't hear a word of what's going on around them. They know someone's talking to them. They know that the people are responding to what they themselves are saying, and there seems to be a dialogue going on, but they can't hear a single word. Well, what's happening is they've pulled to the front an alter personality, which is reporting back to the military people, telling them whatever they want to know. It has its own institutional memory, its own know-how, its own skill set, its own life for all intents and purposes. So if any of the listeners have found themselves in that kind of a situation where all these military people are around them, talking to them, interacting with them, but they don't hear a single word, that's what's happening. They've pulled forth an alter personality.
Well, that's the thing, James.
Do you want to comment or anything?
Yeah. The first thing is you're using the word military. Now, the military I know has three branches, is land, sea, and air. And we would expect, would we not, that it would be the air people who are, you know, looking after UFOs and things like that. But it seems to be that it's not the air or the land, but it's the sea people who are the military that is involved in this thing. Is that right?
Yes, to a large degree, the Navy, deep black elements of the Navy and naval intelligence are deeply involved. And there's a logic to this also. I mean, in a logical world, there is a logic to it. Now, there are elements, deep black elements of the Air Force and the Army that are deeply involved in this as well. But the Navy has always been deeply involved in the secret alien technology and alien MILAD scenario. If we go back to service-level history, of all the branches in the service, the Navy was always the most technologically oriented. The Office of Naval Intelligence was the first overseas intelligence agency, a foreign intelligence gathering agency developed by the U.S. government. Prior to that, the U.S. Army, the Federal Army, had created their own intelligence service during the American Civil War. But the Office of Naval Intelligence was particularly tasked with technological information and technological acquisition, and they would send their attachés and their operatives all over the world, especially when the U.S. Navy was transitioning from a wooden sail-based navy, and then they were transitioning to a steel-hulled, coal-driven, steam-powered navy. Even though the U.S. Navy and the Confederate Navy were the first two to create what they called ironclads, these are basically wooden ships with metal hulls, strapped to the sides of the ship. After the American Civil War, they kind of stopped doing that. But all these other navies around the world got into the steel navy, charcoal-driven boiler kind of engine thing. And the U.S. Navy fell behind. So they sent these attachés and operatives all over the world by hook and crook to steal blueprints, to obtain metal, to obtain all kinds of information in order to make the U.S. Navy catch up. Now, fast forward to Roswell. When Roswell happened, although the U.S. Army Air Force was the agency that was principally responsible for recovering the alien technology that had crashed, and Roswell was certainly not the first time this had happened, although it may have been the first time that they were able to have, due to the fact that one of the larger craft had apparently blown apart and crash-landed in the so-called debris field, they were able to come up with a lot of different components. Sometimes when they recover these craft, JP, they can't even open them. They just store them somewhere because they don't have a means of getting inside of them, right? Well, Roswell was different because at least one of the craft kind of blew apart and left a very large debris field. So although the U.S. Army Air Force, as later became the Air Force, was the key player in recovering a lot of this, and then they brought a lot of the recovered technology to various bases, including the Air Materiel Command at Wright Field, later Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. Eventually, the Navy got a hold of a lot of that technology and began performing analysis, the Office of Naval Research, Office of Naval Intelligence. ONI is an agency within Naval Intelligence. It's a lot of people think that, ONI is the Naval Intelligence. Actually, it's an agency within Naval Intelligence. And And also what happens is the Navy began having primacy in a lot of the covert back engineering efforts of the secret alien space program. The late, great Leonard Stringfield himself, a former Air Force intelligence officer, Army Air Force intelligence officer during World War II, he talked about the famous crash of alien craft in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, in December 9th, 1965. It was recovered by elements of the military, I believe an Air Force element, and the craft was transported to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where, according to Stringfield's informants, it was the Navy that was working on trying to gain access into the craft. It could have been the Army or that was involved in the recovery as well, but when they got it to Wright-Patt, it was the Navy, according to Stringfield's eyewitness sources, who were actively trying to gain access into the craft, and they used a variety of means. Most of them were unsuccessful. Again, it was one of those craft they just couldn't get into. So fast forward to today, although different branches of the military are deeply involved in the secret UFO alien program, deep black elements of the Navy, and in particular naval intelligence, have always been involved. And I would go so far as to suggest that the secret space program, as it's been described, is not a monolithic block. I believe that there's a number of different factions at work. What usually happens after the military recovers these craft, whether it was shot down, whether it came to grief on its own, whether it was part of some kind of alien exchange program, which does happen, because in some of these underground bases there is an ongoing interaction between non-human life forms, various stripes, and deep black elements of the military. What happens eventually for a lot of these craft is they wind up in private, i.e. corporate hands, the infamous mega aerospace corporations, which are merging at an alarming rate. In the old days, there was only six or seven aircraft companies, all of which received seed money and financing from the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, by the way. So from the very start, the reptilian human hybrids that control the aircraft industry, which later morphed into the gigantic aerospace corporations with their satellite divisions, their missile divisions, and their deep black back engineering efforts. But I do believe there are elements of the secret space program, if you will, that as much as possible tries to operate as their own distinct identity entity, just like as is the case with a lot of surface-level intelligence agencies. Survival and empire expansion is the name of the game. So some of these factions of the military have, I believe, forged their own alliances and links with subterranean civilizations as well as off-world civilizations. And there seems to be, at some level, some kind of conflict between them, because the more negative-oriented ETs and subterranean beings, such as factions of the reptilians and some of the greys and some of the mantis beings, et cetera, they seem to have asserted control over some, at least some parts of this secret space program. And so the humans in those programs are, for all intents and purposes, merely proxies, appendages, doing the bidding of the aliens. They're not a standalone, distinct organization. They're under control. And I believe that, and this is just what I've intuitively picking up, and what I've learned over time, that there are some factions that have forged their own alliances and try to have as much as possible their own standalone ops, entirely separate from what these other groups are doing. And they in the process, they forge their own alliances with aliens that may be in conflict with other alien groups that have developed asserted control over other factions of the military. So it's one big mess. It's like a cosmic version of Beirut in the 70s, basically.
Yeah, it's a very
all these manipulated factions.
a very complex story that is out next week. You met Alex a long time ago, you were saying.
Yes, I was part of that San Diego UFO crowd, and I was a member in good standing of the San Diego UFO Society, and Alex used to attend those lectures, and so we had occasion to hang out. I don't even know if Alex remembers me, but we talked on the phone a number of times, and for a period of time, we were meeting about once a month at a Denny's restaurant, which in America is an all-night kind of like restaurant, and we would meet in Carlsbad, California, which was halfway between us. He was up in Oceanside, California. I was down in, I believe at the time, in Claremont, which is a suburb of San Diego. So Carlsbad was kind of a halfway meeting point for us. And Alex doesn't know what I'm going to tell you now. It was an interesting experience. He and I were sitting at a corner booth in a Denny's restaurant. Alex had his back to the window, and he was talking to me. And this car pulled up right outside the window, and in the driver's seat was one of these – it was one of these archetypal, full-on hybrid, maybe even a clone. For many years, the deep black military has seemed to clone out a lot of these hybrids, and these hybrids would be human in appearance, but they would be oftentimes tall, kind of raw-boned, square-jawed, blonde hair or sandy brown hair, and sometimes they could manifest quite a bit of psychic energy and psychic power. On one occasion, I had this clone sitting in the passenger seat of a U.S. Marine Corps white sedan. It parked in front of the headquarters I was working at, and it parked in the admiral's spot, I might add, because it was that command, ComNav AirPAC, Commander Naval Air Forces, U.S. Pacific Fleet, was run by a 3-star vice admiral. Anyway, so this U.S. Marine Corps white sedan parks in the admiral's spot, and it was just a psyop against me. The driver, it was so tall I could only see up to his shoulders. He was wearing a camouflage pattern BDUs, and he was speaking into a walkie-talkie, you know, for kind of theatrical effect. And then in the passenger seat was this very tall, blonde-haired, square-jawed, hybrid clone who was giving me the evil eye and sending me a lot of this negative energy. And it was parked in such a way that where my desk was situated along one of the walls. So this is post the John Walker spy scandal. So all the communications places for the Navy had to put hedges up and trees, leafy trees in front of their windows, and then put metal bars on the windows, I guess to keep the spies out somehow, right? So they parked in a spot where the hybrid clone in the passenger seat had a diagonal line of sight with me. And I didn't even see him. What I did was I felt the presence. I felt the presence kind of zooming in on me and plugging into what's been called the push. They even made like a movie about this, and they're taking terms from us again. But what some of these hybrids with a reptilian consciousness in particular can do is they can push their thoughts into humans and abductees, scream at them telepathically in their minds. Anyway, that's what this clone was doing to me. And then when I peered through the leaves and through the iron bars of the window to see the source of this thing, I see this white sedan with the U.S. Marine Corps in black paint on the side, spelled in black paint on the side. And I see the two guys that I just mentioned, and the guy in the passenger seat was giving me the evil eye, just pushing these malevolent thoughts into my conscious mind. Okay, well, that's how they're, you know, that's how they're rolling today, I was thinking, right? Fast forward to when I was sitting with Alex in a Denny's restaurant, and Alex had his back turned to the window, and right outside, this car pulls up, and in the driver's seat was one of these cloned out military tall guys again with a square jaw, sandy brown hair, and giving me the evil eye. Well, he might have been giving Alex the evil eye. I don't know. But Alex didn't know he was behind him. And I didn't tell Alex that. I said, oh, by the way, Alex, there's this, like, this crazed hybrid behind us, you know, giving us the evil eye. So I didn't even bother telling Alex, and Alex just kept talking. I just thought it was kind of funny. You know what I mean? To this day, I've told some people that story, but I never told Alex that story. So if you run into him again, tell him that. And he sat there all pissed off and fuming, this cloned out tall guy. And then after a while, he drove away, and Alex was none the wiser. Reminds me of another time I was sitting at the Oakland International Airport. I knew a guy who was a former CO for a P-3 Orion squadron, and then he began working at the P-3 Orion desk at the headquarters I worked at. And these naval aviators, they literally call themselves by their call signs, right? Oh, you know, Maverick and Jester. They really call themselves that. It's stupid. And then they even sign off their correspondence that way. Anyway, so I was with this guy, Rowdy. That was his call sign. And we were at the Oakland International Airport at the bar waiting for our flight, because he lived in Livermore, which is not too far from the Livermore National Labs, where they create all these weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, et cetera. And he happened to live in the town of Livermore. And I lived in my folks lived in San Jose at the time. So every once in a while, he'd ask me, hey, you feel like going back to San Jose this weekend? We had the, you know, he had the frequent flyer kind of a buddy program going. So for $40, this is like the early 90s, I can get a round trip ticket. I can just go from San Diego, shoot up to San Jose for a weekend, and then come back, right? And Oakland was always easier to fly into, vice SFO, San Francisco International. So we would fly into Oakland. Anyway, we're sitting in the bar at Oakland International. Rowdy has his back to the real long windows that face out towards one of the runways, and Rowdy was going into this rant about how back when he used to go on deployments, these women in his command would try to get themselves pregnant, so they would avoid the Westpac tour, right, the Western Pacific tour or whatever. And he was like, he was going on basically on this anti, like, woman rant for a while. And while he was in the midst of this rant, going from right to left, about 15 feet above the runway was a gleaming silver saucer that was just, that zipped right above the runway from right to left. I didn't even bat an eyelash. I just kept listening to Rowdy rant about women in the military, right? This is when they were first starting to bring women in during the Clinton administration. And likewise, just as the case with Alex, around that same period of time, I didn't bother to enlighten, you know, Rowdy that, you know, a flying saucer had just flown behind him, right? That might have upset him. Interesting side note. I was working at the airbase, and this woman came along. She was a contractor, and she said that you know, she'd worked at a number of places working on computer databases, like the one at the Marine Corps Recruiting Depot, MCRD, which in the old days, I don't know since they did all this realignment, but it was the West Coast version of the eastern part of the U.S. Paris Island, where they trained a lot of the East Coast Marines, the recruits, the boots. Well, in the West Coast, in San Diego, they had MCRD, Marine Corps Recruiting Depot, and she'd worked there, and she'd worked at the big Marine base at Camp Pendleton, and she'd worked at and at that point, when I met her, she was doing contract work at the base that I worked at, right? So we got into a discussion, and as was so often the case in those days, and I don't even know how we got on the subject, right, of clones, she said that her and her girlfriends used to go out to the nightclubs frequented by U.S. Marines in and around Camp Pendleton, which is Oceanside, California. Actually, that's where Alex used to live, if memory serves. Anyway, she said her and her girlfriends kept running into these Marines, very tall, square-jawed, blonde hair or light brown hair, and they seemed to manifest little or no personality. Okay. Now, these gals that this computer programming lady hung out with, for all intents and purposes, not passing a value judgment whatsoever, but, like, they were kind of like Marine groupies. And you'll find gals like this. Like, if you go to the Navy SEAL bars in and around Coronado, California, San Diego, you'll see gals that like to hang around, you know, the Navy SEALs. And likewise, around Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where the Army Special Forces and Delta Force are, that you'll see gals that hang around those places. Well, anyway, these gals were hanging around these nightclubs and dance clubs frequented by U.S. Marines. And they kept running into these tall, square-jawed, light blonde hair, light, you know, sandy brown hair Marines that evinced little or no outward emotion. And they seemed to only talk like in monosyllabic grunts, right? Now, there would be some that would argue that, you know, a lot of Marines are like that anyway. I think of the old naval aviator joke about Marine aviators. How do Marine aviators drop their ordnance? They invert, go upside down, and the Marine pilot drops out with a knife, right? Okay, the Marines have been a butt of jokes, you know, for a long time. And I'm not making fun of them. I'm just saying a fact. But anyway, these Marines they kept running into seemed to have little or no personality and didn't even seem to talk much. And so this sparked the curiosity of the computer programmer lady, contractor lady. And what she did was, get this, she had access to all these computer databases in MCRD and in Camp Pendleton, and she found out, get this, that every single one of those kind of like monosyllabic kind of no personality Marines she kept running into, they all hailed from small towns in and around Los Alamos, New Mexico. Could be a coincidence that Los Alamos, New Mexico, for whatever reason, the Department of Energy had their human genome project, and they're not the only one, right? There's been underground genetics programs going on for decades now. But I thought it was interesting, and she thought it was interesting, that all these guys she kept running into that had no sexual interest in these women that were practically hanging all over them, they all hailed from these little towns in New Mexico. Go figure. Anyway, and Alex and I hung out a bit in the old days, and we talked, and he was, I would say that back in those days, and I was going through a lot of challenges at times too, and going through my own, issues, ET related and whatnot, and he was a source of comfort and inspiration and guidance for me, I must say. And I was there at that lecture. I can't remember if it was a Whole Life Expo in Los Angeles, Pasadena, someplace, because I'd seen Alex give a number of lectures. And kudos to Alex, because way back when he was talking about the Orion Group, he was talking about the Dracos and what they were up to. And there was only a few people around, like Dr. Carla Turner, that were talking about the hardcore stuff. And Alex is one of them. Anyway, I was at that lecture, and he may have said this in more than one lecture, but you'll find a very short snippet of this online on YouTube, maybe about 40, 50 seconds worth, where Alex talks about how the world government is going to flood Japan and sometime in the future. And sure enough, we have Fukushima, you know, roll around and all the hellish aftermath of that as far as the out-of-control radiation and whatnot. But Alex called that. He predicted that way back when. And a lot of the predictions Alex made back in those days, where they were going to announce that they found water, you know, abundant water in different parts of the solar system, absolutely came to pass. And I do believe there has been a lot of time manipulation, not just by ETs, but elements of the deep black military, because the secret government, if you will, I'm not talking just about the secret, you know, surface level, you know, black ops, that kind of thing. I'm talking about the weird science elements of the secret military, secret government, secret industry. They've long since strived to duplicate, if not exceed, the alien technology which has come into their possession, and which they've learned either through guidance from their alien benefactors, if you will, or through their own research, development, back engineering efforts. They've long since strived to not only duplicate alien technology and capabilities, but exceed it. And I'm satisfied by this point that elements of the deep black military that work with aliens, that they've long since been involved in time travel, alternate reality ops, timeline operations going forward or backwards in time in a given timeline, so on and so forth. And I'm satisfied that certain things have been done to our timeline. Our aboriginal timeline, if you will, is non-existent. It's been changed so many times that now we have people talking about the Berenstain Bears, talking about the Mandela effect, and I've experienced this myself. There are things that I took part in which involve thousands of people, but history seems to have changed, and either people don't remember what happened back then, which I know to have happened, but on the other hand, many people do. Many people do know for a fact that, and Nancy Hopkins and a number of us, and Walt Silva, we had a long discussion about this in one of the shows I did with them about how even in their personal life, Nancy tells a story of how she went to a home that she was renovating, if memory serves, and the interior and the exterior, things about it were radically different than what she remembered. It's because the timeline has been altered. So when people point at Alex and say, ha ha, you made some predictions that didn't pan out, oh, not so fast. The timeline has been messed with on numerous occasions. Now, the ETs have always been instrumental in altering time. Some of these very desperate ET civilizations that look like Greys, for example, and the various factions of Greys, some of them have reached the end of their evolutionary biological tether. All they can do is endlessly like clone themselves and transfer their consciousness from one succeeding clone generation to another. So what they've been doing is this long-term hybridization process with humans and using humans as a DNA resource to revivify their biology. They're creating this hybrid race between the two of us. And I do believe that those military clones, clone hybrids that I just described earlier, are like that. Except in those cases, I believe they have a reptilian consciousness in them. But what these time-manipulating ETs have done in order to give their hybridization program more time, pardon my redundancy, to work, they've messed with time on a number of occasions just to give their hybridization process more time to work. In fact, there's a guy in New Zealand named Alec Newell. He wrote a book called Coevolution, where he was abducted by a particular ET race for 10 days. And that ET race told him something similar, where they mucked around with time in order to give themselves more time to complete this hybridization process of theirs, because they were dying out, basically, right? And so I believe that not only was Alex spot on in a number of his predictions, but some of his predictions, which haven't panned out as of yet, may be due to this time manipulation that's going on, right? So people need to keep that in mind. But I'm really thankful that Alex is back speaking again, and I'm really thankful to you, JP, for helping him, giving him a forum. All these webinars Alex has been putting out are very timely. And Alex has been through his share of challenges, but he's always been a trooper. He's always been a stand-up guy and a spiritual warrior. And I'm really proud to have known, made his acquaintance, way back then, whether or not he even remembers me. You know what I mean? Send him a picture one of these days of me. That might jog his memory.
I'll do so. Because he said it's a long time ago and a lot has happened. So, you probably jog his memory. Well, we're doing, we got him off the streets, really. He was living in a car, and James Harkin and myself. James, it's really, I really want to give a lot of kudos and acknowledgement to James, because he's collected everything that Alex has done. He's gone all over the web, collected it all together in one place, and made a website for him, and put a PayPal donation on it. And if you go to alexcollier.org, you'll see all that. You can get all of this stuff for free. Plus, in order to, earn some money so that it literally pays his rent in an apartment that we got, that he managed to get. He's doing the webinars. Now we're doing two a month. So maybe, in a few months' time, he'll actually be able to buy a car or something, some nice things for himself. He's just basically on survival. So, thank you, James. Yes. So, okay. Oh, so many ways to go. Now, one of the things you talk about timelines. Another thing you're talking about, the square-jawed hybrids. Now I'm going to bring in. Have I got any of my jingles? Let's see if I've got any of my jingles, because I usually have jingles to do this. But I'm going to bring in. Where are they? Where is it? The Nazis.
Mm.
Because I've done a lot of research over the last couple of years into Die Glocke and the development of that. And also I'm very aware that the Nazis started messing about with time. After Die Glocke, the guy who was in it landed at Kecksburg. They, the secret space program picked him up. He sorted a problem with space and time. Released various other workers and prisoners, apparently. This is something that Sean David Morton told me. Released some other prisoners. They came through this time warp at the same time as Kecksburg. So they appeared like 20 feet above the ground, like dropped onto the ground. Some of them landed on bushes and some of them didn't, But they all scurried away when the military turned up to pick up the Glock itself. But so there's knowledge that the Nazis developed time and space travel technologies in the 1940s, and then the extrapolation of that is that they went underground, literally, and have developed their secret space programs, their cloning programs, they're probably the ones who are doing the chemtrails, etc. And also the time traveling thing. So, one of the things you were saying about time travel is that, the original 9/11 was an attack by some very amateurish, Arabs who hijacked a plane to try and crash into the World Trade Center, but it didn't knock it down or anything. But then that, as you would say, aboriginal event, was then, they could lay some bets on it because they knew it was going to happen, and then they could enhance it, and then they gave them the stuff, and probably as they were getting flying towards the building, there were other things going on. So other technologies have been used to enhance these enormous events, and 9/11 being the biggest event, and indeed the excuse for almost continual war since then. What side, from your perspective, over those things that I've just talked about, what are the elements that you recognize and can comment on?
Well, I would say that the Germans were working on advanced technology. Just the surface level stuff that we take for granted, like the V1, which basically was the prototype cruise missile, and then the V2, also called the 810 or 812, if memory serves, was the first ballistic missile. And then, as far as other aspects of their weaponry, even their personal weaponry, like the Panzerfaust, it was an anti-tank weapon that fired a molten flame through the sides of even the thickest armored tanks. You know, the radar guided flak, they're 88 millimeters, the deadliest artillery piece of World War II. The Germans were always at the forefront. They've always been a very industrious race, and the whole history of Germany has just been slandered, undermined. They've been made to look like the most evil people of all time, when in actual fact they actually stood in the middle of Europe and were standing in the gap and doing their level best to keep Europe from being overrun by the Bolsheviks, which unfortunately was meant to happen anyway. And now we see Germany dying another death with this immigration invasion going on. It's not just Germany, Sweden, and Greece and all these other places. It's just a uniform policy to use multiculturalism as a weapon of mass destruction and wipe out these indigenous societies, which unfortunately for them happen to be white, right? So they're just wiping out all these different societies and supplanting it with a new one, order out of chaos. But getting back to the weapons acquisition technology, it's definitely true that the Bell Project, and Dr. Joseph Farrell talks a lot about this. He's written books about it. And the name of the magnetism expert that was one of Wernher von Braun's right-hand men eludes me at the moment, but he was a key player in NASA in a lot of the rocket launches and a lot of the
not Wolf Davis, was it?
I'm sorry?
Kurt or Wolf Davis.
Could have been.
He was one of the Bell Project guys.
Yeah, and the name Hans Klammer kind of.
Oh, Klammer. Yeah,
Klammer.
Yes. Yeah, Klammer was a big feature in Sean David Morton's book, which gives the beginning of the American secret time travel space program thing.
Yeah, and there was two space programs. There was the bogus one that people, you know.
NASA.
At NASA, the moon landing and all that stuff, which is basically just Stanley Kubrick's, you know, film studio, basically. I mean, nobody asked the question, how could they fit this big lunar dune buggy into the tiny little cramped lunar lander, right? That doesn't compute. And there's a whole bunch of other issues. Now, I do believe they got to the moon. They just didn't get there in the way they're telling, you know, in the way they're saying. They got there all right. Alex talked about this years ago, how they got to the moon in the 1950s. That the National Security Agency apparently had some involvement in that. And it was like a joint program with the Russians, if memory serves. But yes, Hans Klammer, that's the guy. And once again, we have this concept of counter-rotating magnets, of using mercury as some kind of a medium, and they found that by doing this, they were able to affect what mainstream physicists refer to as space-time. Now we see a kind of steroids version of that with CERN, once again, two very large counter-rotating magnets. If people study the Manhattan Project, they know about the electromagnetic separation, isotope separation, initiated by Dr. Lawrence, Ernest Lawrence. He's the guy they named the Lawrence Livermore Lab after, and using huge magnets that would spin these elements and then thereby knock off, you know, isotopes, and then in that way enrich and purify the uranium. So the concept of using magnets has been well known for some time. And also we have, of course, the story of the Philadelphia experiment, once again using very powerful magnets in order to affect changes in space-time. So it wouldn't surprise me that along the way, working with this Bell Project, and they seem to have transplanted this project lock, stock, and barrel to to South America, at least, which would have been a good jumping off point to Antarctica. There's lots of stories of the Nazis, the Germans going to Antarctica, but in South America, they would have been left relatively unmolested, the German engineers and the German scientists, where they would have been able to conduct their experiments to their heart's content. And if they realized that operating these counter-rotating magnets and then powering them up to a very high level with high potential electricity, and they could affect space-time, yes, you know, curiosity being what it is, I'm sure that they, at some point they would have decided to push the envelope and see how far they could have gone with this. Again, it's with these deep black intelligence operations the world over, they always want to the primary goal is not only survival but expansion. It's all about empire building. So they would have had the resources, the money, the equipment, etc., to carry out these experiments, and who knows how far they would have gotten with it. I think they would have gotten quite a long further down the track. I believe they would have gone operational at some point. It was no longer a question of just experimentation. They would have gone operational, and that would mean essentially sending individuals and then teams through whatever portals or wormholes or stargates that they would have opened. Now I must say that in some of these deep black military ET programs, stargate travel is actually the norm, where they in some of these underground bases they literally open up these stargates to go to other worlds and even to other planes and other dimensions. It's quite routine nowadays, and I've spoken to many people who've been on these projects and who've gone through stargates. A lot these days is made of like the base or bases on Mars or beneath the Martian surface. But I can say from my understanding and from what I've learned from discussions with a variety of actual participants that Mars is actually quite local. Mars is about as local as walking over to your dining room table or walking over to your refrigerator in your kitchen. It's not a far journey. These stargates are utilized to send teams to the furthest reaches of the cosmos, and also, quite frankly, into other dimensions and other times and other realities, actually alternate realities. So the Germans also would have availed themselves of a lot of the information from ancient India. Remember, like in the discussions in some of the books written by David Hatcher Childress and Dr. Richard Thompson, they talk about the Vimanas, and these are manufactured flying, metallic flying craft, which the gods back then and the human alien hybrids that work for the gods, i.e. the aliens, they utilize these Vimanas and they use them in their wars against other gods. And it turns out, according to the translations of the ancient Indian text, that mercury was utilized in the Vimanas for some reason. And lo and behold, in the German Bell project, apparently they also use mercury in the Bell project. So
yes.
They must have, I'm guessing, they got that idea from a study of the ancient subcontinental texts.
Like, well, I got a little bit of nugget on that for you.
Like the Mahabharata and the Rig Vedas, and et cetera, et cetera. Go ahead.
Well, my research about the Digloka, the information, although they were studying the Vimana, they didn't get all the information off the Vimana. There were several projects that were happening. That there was one with a crazy scientist by the name of Werner Eckert, who was experimenting with various things, trying, and you know, he was one of these mad scientists experimenting on Jews, and he would expose them to various things. including this particular compound of mercury, which was boiled with thorium and iron filings in a plutonium reactor, if I can remember that correctly, which created this magnetic ferrofluid. You know, that's what we call it these days, a ferrofluid. And he called that Serum 525. But here's the interesting bit. And you'll have heard of the Vril Daman, haven't you? Wouldn't you?
Yes.
The message that came through the Vril Daman was that they, now what was it? Yes, that's right. Their contact, who called himself Anquil from Aldebaran, talked about a material that they called Vril. And they said this Vril exists on different planets in different ways. But he said it's a magnetic ferrofluid, as his voice trailed off as the channeling ended. And then when Kamla, Hess, and Eckert, and Seeger, who attended this channeling meeting, all got together, and he said, it's this thing. He said, you know, he was repeating these words. He didn't know what they mean. He said a magnetic ferrofluid. And Kamla remembered that Eckert had been working on these different things, and said, "Ah, maybe this is Serum 525, which is what we call today red mercury, but the Aldebarans called it Vril, and the Nazis called it Serum 525." So there's a little nugget for you.
Yeah, interesting. Also, that in you're probably familiar with a book called The Coming Race, written by. Bulwer Lytton, who was a member of the House of Lords, actually. It's regarded by many as like one of the first works of science fiction, science fantasy. But I believe that Edward Bulwer Lytton came up with the idea because he himself may have been initiated into these secret societies, may have been an adept for all we know. I remember when I read that book, the very first non-human creature described in the book, which is supposed to be a novel, starts out with two guys going spelunking, i.e. cave exploring, in a mine shaft, and then one of them falls down into this hole, hurts himself, and before the younger guy could climb down to attend to the other guy who'd fallen down, before he can climb down, he sees a reptilian creature come out from the shadows and then haul the body away of the guy who'd fallen down. So in that book, the very first entity that's described is a reptilian of all things. And this book was written in the 19th century. The Vril, was an energy source that this race known as the Vril, which were described as being like Nordic in appearance, in this underground cavern system. And the reason it was called The Coming Race, the novel, was from his discussions, he eventually kind of ran afoul of this underground civilization called the Vril. And in talking to some of their elders and members, it emerged that these Vril, who kind of reminded me of Nordics, but really could have been just shape-shifting reptilians for all we know, had told the character in the story that they're going to come to the surface one of these days, and they were going to take over. That's why the story was called, the title of the book was The Coming Race, because they're coming. But the power source which they used to power up all their technology and which gave life to their civilization was referred to as the Vrilia. So very interesting. And then you have the... wasn't there an organization called the Vril Society also?
That's your the source of this channeling group. These were women who.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
now
right.
Here's another thing. Here's another thing that not a lot of people are aware of, is that there was a kind of sex magic going on with these Vril women. Not only did they have this incredibly long hair to act as antennae. But they were also, basically they had to be raised, very much like in the Montauk thing, they had to be raised to a period of sexual, a place of sexual excitement. This is something not spoken about in many of the books, but they, in order to do the channeling, they had to really kind of get off a bit. The Nazi fellows were very pleased because they could help, as it were. So there's another little bit.
And we see, we see similarities with I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with the Babylon working that L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons, if memory serves, was the founder of the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. He was an engineer and a rocket scientist, and he was also an adept. In fact, he had received the charter from Aleister Crowley to open up a branch of Crowley's Ordo Templi Orientis / Argentium Astrium, open up a branch in Southern California. And Parsons began doing these tantric, Mrs. Parsons actually, began doing these tantric rituals with L. Ron Hubbard. Mrs. Parsons played the role of the Scarlet Woman, if you will. And the intention behind the Babylon working was to open a space-time portal for whatever reason. And some people speculated maybe it was to let in, like, the Old Ones, which were referred to by H.P. Lovecraft and some of his gothic novels, whatever the case may be. This happened in around 1946 in near Mount Palomar, which, whether it was Parsons or Hubbard, one of the two, one or the other, described Mount Palomar as being the sexual chakra of the planet Earth. Very interesting. And so, once again, using the power of the Kundalini, just through this means, this tantric ritualistic means, the sexual magic, if you will, the idea was to generate enough power in order to open up a portal. Very interesting. And while we still have time, I wanted to talk about reptilians, but we got into so many different subjects and we're going hither and yon.
You got to come back.
Which is great because those are the best kinds of discussions. What happens sometimes with these reptilians is that if they're having reptilian sexual encounters with a human woman, what they do oftentimes, and has been described by many women, is that the act of being sexually assaulted by a reptilian, not only because the reptilian is often described as having a very large member, but it does seem to have the ability to manipulate the woman's kundalini, and the woman, the women often describe full body orgasms that in some cases could last for 2 hours or longer. Imagine that. And so it's an energetic parasitic harvesting of the woman's kundalini sexual chi energy. And there's a variation of that some of these adepts and warlocks do. Crowley was infamous for this. He would utilize these scarlet women in his tantra rituals and oftentimes leave them kind of debilitated, and some actually went crazy, and apparently some even committed suicide because Crowley wasn't too interested in the well-being or whatever side effects that may occur after the fact. All he wanted to do was utilize these women because Crowley himself was a reptilian-human hybrid. He was probably, in all likelihood, a host for one or more reptilian entities. And the entities working through him would activate the Scarlet Woman's chi and siphon off all that energy. And Crowley himself said that if the Kundalini activation was done in an unbalanced way, it could lead to all kinds of problems for the Scarlet Woman, including insanity, depression, whatever the case may be. Kenneth Grant, in his book, I think it's called Memory Serves the Hidden God, he apparently was a disciple of Crowley's, or at least followed Crowley's teachings, talked about how adepts could utilize coins and placed over, I'm forgetting the terminology here, over the various chakra points, and these coins would absorb the kundalini energy that was released during tantric magical sex. And there were, at any rate, there were like little dish-shaped, coin-shaped objects, metallic, and the coins, if you will, would absorb the energy that was released through the kundalini rising of the scarlet women, and then the coins would then be stored and utilized as a power source later. So again, we have the concept of energetic harvesting and whatnot, parasitical leeching of people. So I would encourage those that are listening, women especially, that are having reptilian experiences. These reptilians they're masters of frequency and resonance. They can densify their entire body and manifest for a period of time in full physical 3D, or they can make only a certain part of their body, be it their claws, be it their hands, be it their member, manifest in physical 3D. A woman can report being raped by a reptilian despite the fact that she's laying beneath layers of bedding, layers of blankets, night clothes. It doesn't matter. If she can manage to move her hands or arms and tries to block, the penetration of her vulva, if she manages to be able to place her hands right over her loins, paradoxically, she may not feel the entities of member, but she can still feel it thrusting within her. So she can't feel it with her hands, but she still feels it with, inside of her. And sometimes women describe being sodomized and vaginally raped at the same time. And then a variation of this is a lot of these reptilian, human hybrids who are astral operators themselves. They take particular delight in astral rape, where they meet some woman either in person, and socially somewhere, or they meet them online, which has been happening a lot over the last decade or so. And then they begin astrally projecting and astrally raping the women. And there's ways that women can protect themselves. There's a reason why, for example, the Native Americans created the dream catcher. The Native Americans were absolutely convinced that, and they were right, that there are beings inhabiting the lower astral planes that at times can mess with a sleeping human being, hence the dream catcher above the bed or wherever they slept, that would tend to block and filter out the negative spiritual elements, only allowing positive dreams and positive spiritual insight, guidance, downloads, etc., to come through. I encourage the women out there to look into tensor rings. You can place a powerful tensor ring underneath your bed. You can wear hematite, like a hematite necklace or something to bed. There's a number of things women can do, and as much as possible, if they know that there's a male out there who's got these astral raptoid capabilities, as much as possible, detach. Do not allow. See, what these astral raptoids do is, the internet is an electromagnetic conduit. So if they get a hold of a photo, for example, of a woman, they can zero in on the residual electromagnetic energy of the woman that was taken at the time of the photograph, and zero in on that, and then just follow her through the ether. And finally wind up where she, the astral raptoid starts showing up in the woman's dreams, starts talking to her in her dreams, mesmerizing her, hypnotizing her, astrally raping her, whatever the case may be. So it's important to block off all contact, detach as much as possible, block unfriend on the internet, sage, their home, sage themselves. There's a number of things women can do. And what these astral raptoids also do is they attach energetic cords that hook into people, like in the solar plexus. The solar plexus is the spiritual intelligence center, if you will. It is also where our will and our volition is. This is why so many entities, including the snake entities, interdimensional snake entities, embed themselves in people's solar plexus. This engenders confusion, vacillation, timidity, unaccountability, procrastination. All these problems can ensue if one or more negative beings attach themselves somehow energetically through cords or actual, you know, implantation right into the solar plexus. But these astral raptoids also lock into the, once again, the lower chakras, the sexual chakra and the base chakra of the women, and they harvest them energetically. And they can leave these women in a fugue state, you know, discombobulated, disorientated, and they're basically just remote batteries that these astral raptoids utilize, you know, to further their own agenda. And they confuse and frighten and mess up the women in the process. And often as not, in this field, the women who are subjected to this kind of astral raptoid crap are women that are just coming into their power, that are divine feminine warriors, that have done a lot of healing, a lot of integration, and they're just on the verge of regaining their, excuse me, quantum multidimensional potential. And those are the women that routinely get attacked by these raptoids. And I've heard horror stories of women who go on to, like, Starseeds International, and they start talking about their positive ET encounters, start talking about their psychic gifts. Next thing you know, all these astral raptoids lurking on Starseeds International, to cite but one example, start astrally raping this woman and messing with her. Not only that, though, but spooks from the Deep Black MyLab and targeted individual mind control organizations, they also lurk on sites like Above Top Secret and Starseeds International, and they look for people who identify themselves as being, you know, very skilled and very psychic and very gifted. And people out there, please do not tell, if you have a very gifted child, so-called indigo child, please don't go trumpeting that online or on Facebook. That should be need-to-know, close-hold information. No one needs to know that you've got a very gifted child, unless you want that kid to be pulled into a weird science project. Okay?
Well, this is the thing. We're supposed to be protecting these children because they need to grow up without being traumatized, so they have their full powers. James, it's been a fantastic 2 hours. We're just going to about out of there we go. Thank you. Please come back. We love you.
I will. Have a good one.
We'll answer your question then. God bless you.